This series of lectures is based largely on the Star Studies, A Critical Guide book. So if you need a fuller account of what I'm talking about, you'll find it there. You can just check the relevant chapters. Most of the lectures relate to a particular chapter. But there's more to it than that book. So I'm also drawing on my work on Bette Davis, which I've been doing since I was a grad student. I did my PhD in the early 90s on Bette Davis and the film she was making at Warner Brothers in the 1930s and 40s. So I've got a couple of sections based around that research. And that's research that I was doing as part of the PhD, which was mainly around gender and sexuality in her films. But I've subsequently published about 12, 13, maybe 14 essays, articles, book chapters on her. And some of that work draws directly on that. In fact, just last week, I finished a new book chapter on Bette Davis and aging. And I'm going to give you a sneak peek of some of that material. So that hasn't gone out there into the world. This is the first place I'll be doing some of that work. And then there's also a piece I finished in the summer for Journal of Transnational Cinemas, which was on the Bollywood star Aishwarya Rai. She's my cover girl, of course. She's on the cover of Star Studies. But in the book itself, I don't go into great detail on her and her career. So after I'd finished the book, I decided to carry on doing research around her. And so I say, I've just published this article on her work. And again, I've incorporated some of that into this lecture series as well. But largely what this series is about, and you will get that impression today, is my love affair with Richard Dyer. Not literal, I have to say, but with his work. Richard has been a total inspiration to me throughout my time as a student and as a scholar and as a writer. He's been hugely supportive of me throughout my career. He was my external examiner at my Viva for my PhD, along with Laura Mulvey. And this book changed my life, basically. Heavenly Bodies. Still carry it round with me when I'm feeling doubtful about what I'm doing. Am I any good? What's the point of all of this? I just read a chapter of Richard Dyer's work and I think, it's all right. I'm okay. So Heavenly Bodies. Actually, the first book, I was in my second year at university on an art history degree that included some film. And I was never very interested in film. I was passionate about painting and sculpture, a little bit of architecture and design and photography. And then film was way down at the bottom of my list. But we were asked to read Richard's Star Studies book. And then in combination with that, I was shown a Bette Davis film from 1942 called Now Voyager. And I'd never seen a Bette Davis film before. And those two things together, Bette Davis and Richard Dyer, went and my life changed. There was like a blinding flash, fireworks went off, full orchestra playing somewhere in the background. And my life would never be the same again. And everything I'm doing now in my life relates back to that moment. That was the big turning point in my life. And that switched me on to film, so that by the time I got to my final year of my degree, I was doing nearly all film courses, and then went on to do an MA at University of East Anglia, where I met Peter Kramer, amongst other people, and Thomas Alsasser. But still, in my heart, I was pursuing ideas that I'd got from Richard Dyer. And my PhD owed a terrific debt to Richard in that I was looking at Bette Davis in the way he had looked at Marilyn Monroe in his chapter in this book, in trying to read her star sign in terms of what was happening around gender and sexuality in America in the 1950s. So that was a big starting point for me. And then the other big kind of critical engagement for me was to think about Bette Davis and her relevant, particularly for gay audiences. And that related very directly to Richard's chapter on Judy Garland in this book. So the way a start can work for different kinds of audiences at the same time, and those different audiences can all get equal pleasure and satisfaction out of a star or a star's films, and yet they're taking those pleasures from something different. Okay. So, Richard's up there. Those two books that have had a profound impact on me are going to be the start. That was the start of my journey, so this is the starting point for you on your journey with me over the next 4 days. Okay, this is where we start. Now, I will just say a little bit of a warning that the starting point is quite dry because I'm beginning with a literature review. So I'm really just looking at what is star studies, how is it developed, who's developed it, what are the key ideas, key arguments. Starting with Richard Dyer, first of all, today, and then moving on to work that has either built on Richard Dyer's work or has gone off in a different direction. So we're doing a literature review. You know, classically, what you do as a grad student when you start a project is look at all the other work that's been done in your area. And once you're on top of that, then you can start to take it down your own particular line of inquiry. So it's going to be fairly dry because I'm mainly talking today about texts and about theories rather than stars themselves. As we get going over the next few days, I'll be talking more about stars, and there'll be juicy bits of gossip for you and all kinds of stuff just to liven the whole thing up. But it's going to be fairly dry. The best lecture will be on Thursday morning. Okay, definitely. We will have really kind of hotted up by then, and we'll all feel comfortable being with each other, and I'll be able to get away with murder, hopefully. Okay. So that's the kind of most interesting one. So forgive me if it's a bit of a dry start. If you're a bit bored today, just think, oh, well, it is going to get better. So do please come back. Okay. So this is what I'm going to do today. I'm going to map out the field of star studies, and I'm going to identify the most influential works associated with it. I'm going to, in particular, discuss Richard Dyer's work, Stars, from 1979, most particularly, with a few references to his second book, Heavenly Bodies. I'm also going to go back, though, beyond Richard, to think about, well, where did those ideas come from? He didn't just invent them or pluck them out of the air. He was building on other people's work. So I shall look at some of that work. And then, finally, as I said before, I'm going to consider how scholars like myself and other people have built on Richard Dyer's work, either taking it further from where he was going or taking it off in a different direction altogether. Okay. So in 1991, Christine Gledhill, in her book Stardom, Industry of Desire, which is an anthology of essays, basically pointed out that Richard Dyer's book had, and I quote, laid the groundwork for star analysis within film studies, recognising that Richard was the first really to provide the foundation for this study, to lay out the blueprints upon, you know, the walls of star studies would then be created. In 2000, Jeanette Van Sandoe wrote something similar. She said that Richard had single-handedly created star studies, that without him there wouldn't be star studies as a recognisable subdisciplinary field of film studies. That's writing in her book on French film stars and stardom. And then more recently in 2006, American writer scholar Karen Hollinger wrote that Richard Dyer's study precipitated a seismic shift in the way in which star studies were perceived. The earth had moved. It had shaken things up. Things would never be quite the same again. Film studies would never be quite the same way again. We would begin to detach ourselves from auteur theory, from authorship, thinking that the director is the sole creator of all meaning in a film, which we all know is rubbish. But also it would shift us away from just looking at films and looking at all that plethora of material that gathers around films, film posters, reviews, trailers, all that other stuff that is part and parcel of cinema. But until this time, till about 1979, nobody was really paying serious critical attention to. She obviously didn't get the point that it's going to get better. Too dry. All right, nevertheless. So this book is the groundbreaking book. It's the book that changed film studies very significantly for a lot of people. What was significant about it was its particular combination of semiotics, on the one hand, as a very systematic way of analysing texts, reading texts, doing textual analysis, with sociology, on the other hand, thinking about these texts as products of capitalism, as products of a particular culture, and reading the texts for what they could tell us about culture, about people, about society, and the way they think and desire. Okay, so, and out of that combination of doing textual analysis quite systematically through semiotics and sociology, reading texts as culture, Richard proposed the notion of what he called the star text. The star text is basically an intellectual construct produced across a range of media and cultural practices. So it's largely films, the films a star makes, but it's not just films. It's their public appearances. It's their appearances in adverts, their appearances in trailers and promotional material, in publicity, in reviews, etc. So the star text then also includes promotional material and publicity. Now in his second book, Heavenly Bodies, published 7 years later in 1986, Richard extended and deepened the nature of his work. And basically here, if you've not had a chance to look at the book already, here he takes three main case studies, three stars, Marilyn Monroe, Paul Robeson, and Judy Garland, and he looks at how each star can be approached in a different way. So he uses a different method of analysing each star, and he's asking different questions about each star. So Marilyn Monroe is chiefly about how she represents ideologies of gender and sexuality in America in the 1950s, early 60s, linking her with the development particularly of Playboy magazine and also the Kinsey reports that were being published around attitudes to sexuality in America in that point. Paul Robeson was looking at a black star who moved between making films in Britain and America, but it really locates the beginnings of his work on race and understanding racial identity, which he subsequently took forward in his book White. And then Judy Garland was really about, as I said before, looking at gay men's relationship to Judy Garland and why she'd been functioning or constructed as a gay icon or queer icon. It's the beginnings, really, of queer theory, but also it's the beginnings within film studies, more seriously, more importantly, of audience research, ethnographic research, in that in terms of approaching this project, the Judy Garland chapter, he doesn't just look at text-based information, but he elicits testimony from a range of men who supply some kind of biographical written material about why and how they engaged with Judy Garland, and that becomes something that Jackie Stacey later adopts for her book, Stargazing, as I'll talk about a little bit later this afternoon. So different methodology for that piece being used. All of this is an opening up of this idea of the star text and beginning to take it into different directions around sexuality and gender, race, and kind of queer theory and audience research. Okay, now the other significance of his second book is it put much more emphasis on audiences and how different kinds of people could read a star differently. So he shifted the focus a little bit away from texts and analysing image to starting to think about the audience and what the audiences are actually doing with stars, why stars are important for audiences, and why they mean so many different things to so many different people. Okay. So that, in a nutshell, is Richard's work, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to unpick that in a little bit more detail. But before I do that, I'm going to take you back further in time now, take you back to the late 1950s, particularly to Paris in 1957, where there is a burgeoning interest, the first major kind of critical engagement with stars and what stars mean culturally or in sociological terms. There are two main books that are quite groundbreaking as star studies that emerge in this same year. One is Roland Barthes' Mythologies, which includes a chapter on Greta Garbo, the face of Garbo, and the power, the emblematic power of her face. But another book that is perhaps more important and more central to film studies than that is Edgar Morin's Les Stars. Again, this was initially published in French, in a French language edition in 1957, and it was only later translated into English through an American university press in 2005. And it's interesting that since it's been translated into English, it's generated a lot more interest. A lot of people now are doing work looking back at Morin and thinking about his significance in terms of star studies. So I know Jeanette Van Sando is currently working on a project all about Edgar Morin. Okay, now Morin's study was really the first kind of cultural studies or sociological engagement with stars, where he thinks about the relevance of French stars and Hollywood stars within society. And again, why people become obsessed with stars, why they imitate stars, what the power of a star is within culture. And here's a quote just to give you a taste of how he's writing about film stars in his book. He says, "The star straddles both sacred and profane, divine and real, aesthetic and magic, like the kings." And what he's really interested in is, I suppose, two things. The way in which, on the one hand, stars in France in the 20th century displaced saints, and the kind, as France moves towards a more secular society, how the icons of the past are shifted from religious icons, the saints, icons of saints, effigies of saints, relics of saints, how that shifts and refocuses onto film stars, theatre stars, and then film stars. The other shift, though, is again how the worshipping of the monarchy and looking up to the monarchy as kind of symbolic figureheads of society who guide new generations through a series of transformations, how that gets shifted in France and located onto film stars, theatre stars and film stars. Okay, so it's the film star is coming to stand in for older traditions of hero worship, if you like, or former types of cultural role models for people. And their symbolic value has changed. He also describes the star as a sacred monster, one born from a conjunction, he says, of capitalism, modernity, and the mythology of love. Sacred monsters. Sacred monsters They're celebrated, they're forgiven, they have a cultural license to do things that ordinary people wouldn't dare do. They can behave badly, and they can still be loved, they can still be forgiven. Again, perhaps like a monarch of some kind. Okay, now in the conclusion to his book Stars in 1979, Richard Dyer acknowledges his debt, in particular to Moran and to a number of other people who've been writing about Stars and working on Stars, 20 years, at least 20 years before Richard sat down to work on his book. And he says, in fact, right at the end of the book, that what he's produced is actually a survey of what has been done in the study of Stars, but also a thinking about what needs to be done. So, you know, he does acknowledge that he's not making this all up from scratch. He's taking ideas, he's taking them forward, he's synthesizing them, and he's thinking about now within film studies, how can we take some of these ideas forward? I think one of the problems with Moran's book, if you read it now, it seems a little bit old-fashioned because it's very quasi-religious. It's got all this religious terminology running through it, and I suppose it does locate itself within mid-20th century, whereas when you read Richard's books from the late 70s and 80s, they seem more contemporary, more forward-looking. Okay, so just to say a little bit more about Stars, then. How many of you actually had a chance to have a look at Stars or have read Stars? Can you indicate if you've actually read Stars? Okay. Not very many. So this will be a very helpful introduction to you, then, of the book itself. The book is divided into three separate sections. Part one is very sociological, and in fact it's entitled Stars as a Social Phenomenon. So it's looking at the place of stars in society. The second part combines sociology with semiotics, with textual analysis, and it's called Stars as Images. And it's thinking about the star texts, the star as a text. And then the third part is more semiotic, so it's more about reading stars in terms of their symbolic value, and it's called Stars as Signs. So it shows you very clearly this combination of sociological engagement and semiotic engagement. Now, texts for Richard are considered as social facts. They're not just something that are created and circulated in a society and don't have social meaning. All texts of any kind have some kind of social meaning. And he reasons that textual assumptions must be grounded in sociological ones. So as someone who's reading and analysing a text, whatever that text is, it might be a poster, it might be an advertisement, it might be a film scene or sequence, then we need to think about the social consequences behind it. Who's it talking to? Who's it is addressing? What is it saying about society in a particular historical moment? So the whole idea of the text collapses into society, or is a portal for us to read society. It's a tangible bit of evidence that we can engage with a society from a particular historical moment. Part of the reason for this is that Dye was educated in Birmingham through the Centre for Cultural Studies that involved the pioneering work of Stuart Hall and people like that. So it's just worth bearing in mind that this study is very much, although it's a film studies text, it's also very much a cultural studies text at the same time. And this is where cultural studies really begins to interface with film studies. And that's all about opening film history up into issues, questions about society and culture and how we represent ourselves. Okay, so, and because this is deeply ingrained in cultural studies and sociology, it's also deeply ingrained with the concept of ideology. of exploring systems of values and beliefs and ideas and ideals. Now, one of the most important key ideas or themes of Richard Dyer's book is this idea of structured polysemy. Basically, polysemy meaning multi-meaning, things having more than one meaning. And it's structured polysemy because those multi-layered meanings have been put in there strategically to be read differently. So it's a text that can be read differently by different people. Okay. So in other words, as you all read this now or look at this, because you're all different people coming from different walks of life with different attitudes, different political beliefs and values, different religious beliefs and values, etc., different subcultural beliefs and values, you'll all get something different out of this same bit of text. Okay, and that's basically an example of what Richard's saying. That's how we all engage with film. We all engage with it slightly differently. And what's important about film, because it's a social medium, it's created collectively, and it's created to be consumed by a mass, not created by one person to be read by one other person individually, then it has to have this multi-layered meanings. Okay, so on page 3 of Stars, Richard Dyer says, and I'll read the quote through for you, "From the perspective of ideology, analysis of stars as images existing in films and other media texts stress their structured polysemy." He doesn't have it in bold in the original. I'm just picking up that phrase as being significant. That is, the finite multiplicity of meanings and effects they embody and the attempt so to structure them that some meanings and effects are foregrounded and others are masked or displaced. The concern of such textual analysis is then not to determine the correct meaning and effect, which one's right, which one is true, but rather to determine what meanings and effects can legitimately be read in them. How these are in fact appropriated or read by members of different classes, genders, races, etc., is beyond the scope of textual analysis, although, he says in brackets, various conceptualizations of this will be found throughout this book. So he's saying, when you're just reading texts, you can't ever read how different people will read them. You can't understand. You can acknowledge that they might be opened up in different ways. There might be ambivalences, contradictions, ambiguities that make this text work for different people. But if you're really going to get to grips with how these texts can be read differently, you need to engage in some kind of audience research. And that's then what he goes on to do in his next book, particularly with that chapter on Judy Garland, where he does actually ask people, audiences, why Judy Garland was their favourite star and what she meant for them. So he doesn't quite do that in this book, but he's pointing ahead to it. He goes on to say, a few pages later, that image building isn't just about economics. Obviously, this is an economic industry, cinema, particularly Hollywood cinema, but there's more to stars and the meaning of stars that go beyond pure economics. So he acknowledges the economic factor is important, but as a cultural studies person, he's got to look at a wider set of meanings beyond that. So again, just to quote, "The enormous economic importance of stars, the elaborate machinery of image building and films, importance in establishing character types, all suggest the potential power of the forces of cinematic production for creating the star phenomenon." So that explains why we have stars. We have stars because there are economic reasons. If you have a star in your film will be watched by greater numbers of people. They'll come to see that film because that star's in it. Put two well-known stars into that film, you'll get even more, an even larger audience. You know, the more stars you put in, the more audience you'll get, because fans of those stars will all come and watch that film. So we know there's an economic factor behind why films have stars, why there is a star system. But that's not the end of the story. However, these explanations of the star phenomenon are not sufficient in themselves, and we need to see the phenomenon in its cultural, historical, and ideological context to understand where the producers' ideas and images of stardom and of specific stars themselves come from. Okay. To illustrate, we'll think about Marilyn Monroe. We're going to be thinking a lot about Marilyn Monroe on this course. Forgive me if you don't like Marilyn Monroe. Do we all know who Marilyn Monroe is? That's why I've chosen Marilyn Monroe. We all know who Marilyn Monroe is. I walked around the town last night to see if I could see any Hollywood film stars. I don't mean real Hollywood film stars. I mean pictures of Hollywood film stars. And I expected to see in at least one shop window a picture of Marilyn Monroe. I'm convinced she's there. I shall go around tonight to see if there's a picture somewhere. It might be in a shop that sells cards or posters. It might be in a hairdressing salon. It might be in a record shop or a bookshop. But there'll be some. Marilyn Monroe is here in this town now. Okay? I couldn't find her last night. I found Charlie Chaplin and I found Audrey Hepburn. Okay? So those were my Hollywood stars that I found. But Marilyn Monroe. So Marilyn Monroe, she's everywhere still. She has common currency. So that's why I'm going to talk quite a lot about Marilyn Monroe. Take Marilyn Monroe. There was a very good reason why Marilyn Monroe was put into films in Hollywood in the 1950s and early 60s, because she had a lot of fans who would come and see whatever she appeared in. So simple economic factor. Put Marilyn Monroe in that film and you'll make more money. But that's not the end of her significance for us as scholars interested in stardom. Yes, we need to know, why was she commercially successful? Why having Marilyn in that film rather than someone else would make that film more box office? There are wider cultural, historical questions, ideological questions about why Marilyn in that time. What was it about Marilyn? Yeah, we know she was successful, she had a fan base, but what else was it that was kind of zeitgeisty? You know, what was it about her that made her right at that moment, made the 50s the right time for Marilyn Monroe, in a way that perhaps in the 40s she wouldn't have been successful? During the Second World War, when mainly women over the age of 30 were going to the cinema, that was the dominant time, when there were new icons of femininity, when there was this whole drive towards the Rosie the Riveter, much more masculinized female identity. Why Marilyn wouldn't have worked? But in the 50s, she worked. So there are other questions about why and the 50s in America. That goes beyond the economic. So we don't forget the economic, but we think about bigger cultural questions. Now, thinking about audience-star relations and why audiences relate to stars, Dyer defines four main aspects. He talks about emotional affinity, that we engage with a particular star because we feel for them. We feel we care about them. And they seem to represent something to us that we can maybe identify with, but also we can feel what they feel, you know. They're like almost, close friend, or even though we've never met them, perhaps we feel closer to them in some ways than some of our closest friends. Then there's the self-identity. Maybe we like that star and we follow that star because we see ourselves very directly in that star. They may look like us, speak like us, come from a similar position in life that we can identify with. We might like that star, we might engage with that star because we can imitate that star. And adopting aspects of that star strengthen us. They give us a cultural currency. They give us something in the world that we can adapt to our own advantage. So recognizing that imitation is also an important part. And that's clearly something that Jackie Stacey builds on in the late 80s, early 90s in her book Stargazing. And then there's also this idea of projection, that we can use stars to project onto them our own thoughts and fantasies and desires. So we can use them as an object, either as a sexual object or as a kind of ideal, as a role model of some kind. So in some ways we're taking things from stars, in other ways we're putting things onto stars, and stars are carrying the burden of things on our behalf. Okay, now this often involves an issue of recognition, of seeing ourselves in a star, but also seeing a star as something different, something unique and special and magical, beyond us and kind of untouchable. You know, that's the glamour of stars. So here's another quote from his book. "One of the problems in coming to grips with the phenomenon of stardom is the extreme ambiguity / contradiction concerning stars as ordinary and stars as special. Are they just like you and me, or do consumption and success transform them or reflect something different? So on the one hand, we identify with stars. They are our representatives there on the screen in films. So they have to be, to some extent, like us so that we can engage with them. But actually, we don't really want icons who are like us. How boring would that be? We wouldn't need them in the first place. We want them to be bigger and bolder and greater and more talented and more beautiful and more sexually desirable than the rest of us. You know, that's why we've chosen them, as something special and magical." So there's a paradox at the very heart of stardom. Stars have to be like us, but not like us. What? At the same time or on different occasions? But there's a paradox. So the paradox of the extravagant lifestyle and success of stars, and he's talking particularly about Hollywood stars here, that have swimming pools and are driven around in limousines and have security guards and wear dark glasses, sunshades all the time, and designer clothing. Okay, so there's a paradox that the extravagant lifestyle and success of stars being perceived as ordinary may be explained in several ways. First, stars, however glamorous they are, can actually seem ordinary, be seen as ordinary people who live more expensively than the rest of us, but are not essentially transformed by this. Okay. So even though somehow they're enjoying this life of great wealth, still at the core of them, they're the same person, they're the same vulnerable person, and that's how we identify with them. Second, the wealth and success of stars can be seen as serving to isolate certain human qualities, the qualities they stand for, without the representation of those qualities being muddied by material considerations or problems. Okay, so stars, once they're commercially successful, are not necessarily removed from reality. They can actually begin to express real humanity, what in essence it is to be human, because they're not worried about paying the bills, having to do that. They're kind of lifted out of that. So material success makes them pure icons of humanity, if you like, and that's what we identify with. So they might not live humdrum lives like the rest of us, worrying about how we pay the rent, but what they do is they live lives wondering about how to live to be a good person. Basic humanity. Okay, both of these explanations fit with notions that human attributes exist independently of material circumstances. So the idea or the ideal is that whatever your social condition, you may well be the same person. I would like to think, however rich and famous I become, and obviously it's not going to happen, but let's pretend it did, that I would still be the same person, that it wouldn't change me, you know, that if I won the lottery tomorrow, then I would still be me. And the core of who I am would stay the same. And I'm sure you would all want to think that about yourself. And in a way, that's what we think about as stars. The stars we connect to, the stars who are important to us, are those who we think have a core humanness about them that has nothing to do with how much money they have or what they own or how glamorous they are. But somehow it's what they personify to us in terms of their core human ideals. Okay. Now here's another paradox. The one paradox is stars are both ordinary and special. They're both like us and very different from us. But there's another paradox, is that stars are both types. They represent a type of person, a social category, of which they are the leading representative. But also, they are pure individuals. They're like no other person. They're special. The reason they're paid all that money, $20 million, to appear in a film, for instance, is because they're like no other actor who's available. They bring something unique to that role that no other actor can bring. So again, there's another paradox at the heart of stardom and stars, which makes the whole analysis of them tricky, slippery, complicated. So Dyer writes that stars relate to the social types of society, and also that the star both fulfills / incarnates the type, and by virtue of her or his idiosyncrasies, they individuate it. Okay, so stars are both types, they represent a particular type of person, but on the other hand, they're completely unique. So Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe is a dumb blonde. Okay, she represents dumb blondness, like nobody else. She's the absolute ultimate dumb blonde. She had it down to a T, and she perfected that type to perfection. And she plays it in nearly every role she takes on. Okay, the dumb blonde. But she's not any dumb blonde. She's Marilyn Monroe. So if you compare her to other dumb blondes, compare her to Jane Mansfield or Diana Dawes, British blonde, Marilyn Monroe is completely different. Okay, so it's that, both a type and individual, that a star has to negotiate, and that we as scholars have to negotiate. We have to hone in on what's typical and what's extraordinary, what's individual. So stars embody social types, but star images are always more complex and specific than types. Types are, as it were, the ground on which a particular star's image is constructed. So it's their type that establishes them. So again, Marilyn Monroe comes to fame by being a dumb blonde, and she plays the dumb blonde in a number of films, but she's not quite a star at that point. She's just one of any number of dumb blondes. And then in the early 50s, from 52, 53, she becomes Marilyn Monroe. She's no longer just a dumb blonde. She is now a distinctive star who does something different with the category of the dumb blonde. And you'll see that if you manage to stick this course out to the end, it's only 4 days of your life, you'll see that played out in the film My Week with Marilyn. Okay. So, analysing star discourses. It's complicated, it's tricky, because there are all these paradoxes that we've got to deal with that are not straightforward. It's also tricky because there's a lot for us to analyse. So there's a whole plethora, for instance, of different kinds of star text. There's all the films we've got to look at. You know, and you take any classical Hollywood film from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and you'll probably find they've made at least 50 films, possibly 100, sometimes even more. All of those constitute that star text. That's a lot of films to think about and analyse. Select from the most representative. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, because then there are all those countless interviews in magazines and newspapers and adverts and all and their product endorsements and all the other activity that they're involved with throughout their career, which is central to their career. It's part of their contractual obligation, and it's part of how they make their living. So this isn't secondary, this stuff, the non-filmy stuff. This is fundamental to understanding a star and the star text. So it's a lot of work involved. Clearly the emphasis is on textual analysis, on us as scholars analysing these different texts, and also thinking about films as something different, thinking about films not as the director's creation anymore, but films that are often read as star vehicles. The meanings, the way, the structure, the style, the content are determined by the main star in that film, who will necessarily change the film in either major or subtle ways according to their star identity. So you might have a film that has this script, this director, this producer, but it'll be three completely different films according to who the film star is chosen for the main role. Because the minute the star has been determined, everything else changes subtly. The script has to be modified in some way. The way the director works has to be modified in some way. So it's putting the star into the driving seat as the creator of the film. So Dyett points out, and this was quite revolutionary in 1979. This wasn't where film scholars were at. Film scholars were all about films are valuable and worthy of study if they are the creation of a particular author, the director, who has a particular style and vision that he usually produces in film after film after film, and all of them carry his signature. This is different because this is giving value to somebody else as part of the creator of the film, the star. Dyett points out that films, particularly Hollywood films, were often built around star images. Stories might be written expressly to feature a given star, or books might be brought for production with a star in mind. Sometimes alterations to the story might be effected in order to preserve the star's image. This is what is implied in the term star vehicle, a term actually used by Hollywood itself. The notion that many films produced in Hollywood after 1920, right the way through to the present day, are star vehicles. They're chosen for the express reason of functioning well for a particular actor, a well-known star actor. Okay, so we're thinking about films in a different way now than traditionally how films have been thought about up until 1979. We're also looking at different stuff. We're not just looking at films, but we're looking at criticism and commentary. And this puts onto the agenda reviews, film reviews, looking at film reviews and analysing film reviews, which hadn't really been given much attention prior to this. So writing about criticism and commentary, Dyett says, this refers to what is said or written about the star in terms of appreciation or interpretation by critics and writers. It covers contemporary and subsequent writings, including obituaries and other written material after the star's death or retirement, and is found in film reviews, books on films. To this can be added film, radio and television profiles of stars. These always appear after the initial promotion of the filmmaking of a star, although they may act back on subsequent promotion and filmic activity. So again, it's complicated and it's takes a lot of time and effort, because it means as star scholars we have to not only look at the films, we have to look at the reviews of the films and the publicity and the promotional material, i.e. look at the press books, for instance, that were produced to accompany each film to get it out there, create ballyhoo to get people to come and see it in the cinema. But it's also not just the stuff from when the film was made, but it's everything subsequently written about that film and that star from that moment on. So if the film was made in 1953, How to Marry a Millionaire, Marilyn Monroe vehicle, then it's everything produced around that film in that year, but everything else written about that film from that point on up to the present day. That's a lot of work. Okay. Star scholarship isn't easy. It takes a lot of time, a lot of different methodologies to be used. Okay, now part three of stars. Here the focus is really on acting and performance, including on how stars create characters, how they do characterization. This includes how audiences identify with characters on screen, but it goes beyond that to think about how actors build characters. Dyer identifies three distinct modes of star-character relationship. He talks about the selective use of a star. This is where the characters that a star plays, the actor plays in a film, reveals particular aspects of the star's persona, the star's image. So characters are created so that stars can slot into them. And part of the character, we read the star. So, you know, in a Marilyn Monroe film, part of it's her character that she's creating. So as you'll see in a clip I'll show you in a forthcoming lecture, she plays a Victorian chorus girl, showgirl called Elsie in a film called The Prince and the Showgirl. And so part of that is how she fits and adapts into Elsie. But actually there are moments in the film where she's just being Marilyn Monroe. Okay, so that's the selective fit. Then there's the perfect fit. There's the fit where everything, the whole character has just been created to accommodate the star's image. And it's really the star just being themselves throughout the whole film. There's almost no other character for them to inhabit because the character's designed to match the star persona. So again, you might find in a Marlene Dietrich film or a Garbo film, the character is just Garbo, it's just Dietrich doing Dietrich-y type things, saying Dietrich-y type things. So that's the perfect fit. Then there's also the problematic fit, where stars don't quite fit, where they're asked to play a role where somehow their star persona clashes against the character they're performing. So for instance, Bette Davis, who was known as quite a tough, feisty fighter, rebellious woman in the 1930s, as I'll explain to you in a forthcoming lecture, sometimes she'd have to play these very fragile, vulnerable, feminine characters. And clearly her star persona didn't fit. But the challenge for her as an actress was to adapt herself so that she goes into character. So there's three different kinds of role for stars. Selective, perfect, and problematic. And they all work. It's not that one doesn't work and another does. Okay. Towards the end of his book, page 131, he says, what analysis is concerned to do is both to discover the nature of the fit between star, image, and character, and where the fit is not perfect or selective, to work out where the contradictions are articulated, where things don't quite match. It's identifying those bits, the contradictions. And to attempt to see what possible sources of masking or pseudo-unification the film offers, such as the irresistible unifying force of the, such as the irresistible unifying force of the star image. Okay, so looking at how well stars fit into their character is part of how films are analysed. He also says that any attempt to analyse performance runs up against the extreme complexity and ambiguity of performance signs and how we read them. And one of the things he acknowledges is that whatever style of performance an actor is doing, we might not read them according to that style. So a particular actor might be trained in a particular tradition, where if they hold a particular pose, it will convey a particular meaning. But if we are watching this film out of that historical or national context, we might not know that. So we might read that gesture as being something else, okay, something different. Okay, so, you know, a star doing that in a film might mean something very particular in a historical moment, but we might read that as giving them the finger, which in a contemporary context means something radically different. I mean, that might originally have meant I am, or I have thought. Okay, the signs of performance are facial expression, voice, gesture, principally of hands and arms, but also any limb, neck, leg, etc. Body posture, how someone is standing or sitting. Body movement, the movement of the whole body, including how someone stands up or sits down, how they walk, run. All of these we can read in different ways. And of these, the first is often held to be the most important, the facial expression. In cinema, there's a heavy concentration on the face, and stars tend to be filmed in close-up. They tend to get more close-ups than anyone else. In fact, some stars have it written into their contract that they literally get more close-ups than anyone else in the cast, because that's where we really identify and engage with them. Okay, so we trust that most meaning is conveyed to us from a star through facial expression. But obviously we read all those other gestures as well. And obviously there's huge scope there for ambiguity, for misreading, rereading. Okay, so our reading of performance signs depends in the first instance on our very general knowledge of what intonation, gesture, eye dilations mean. So if someone's pupils suddenly expand and we see that in a close-up, we might read that as desire or we might read it as fear. This knowledge is culture and history bound. Different cultures, these things have different meanings. So within Indian cultures, for instance, gestures convey much more elaborated meanings and very different meanings than within Western cultures. Okay. The signification of a given performance sign is determined by its place within culturally and historically specific codes. In other words, in terms of film, to read Betty Davis's eye movements or John Wayne's walk, we cannot refer to a general and universal vocabulary of eye and walking movements, but to specific vocabularies, specific to the culture and specific within it. Okay? So Betty Davis's eye movements in the 1930s in American films mean something to American audiences in the 1930s. Specific. It wouldn't necessarily mean the same thing to Indian audiences, Chinese audiences watching at those films now. Nevertheless, there are particular human dimensions, universal dimensions to these things that don't really change, because we all relate as a species. We all move in particular ways as a species. So there's the culturally specific and there's the universal. So again, another paradox. Star studies is tricky, it's messy, it's complicated because of all of these paradoxes. Okay. So ultimately then, this is, as I said before, a cultural studies approach to analysing screen performances. The emphasis is on interpretation by audiences rather than the intentions of the actors. Okay. Something that a lot of star studies scholars have been interested in since Dyer's work has been identifying a particular signature style for an actor, a particular way for an actor to move and speak and express, that becomes particular to them and can be imitated, and once imitated by someone else, we all know who it is. that they're imitating. So stars, many stars, develop their own unique ways of walking, moving, being. A star will have a particular performance style that through its familiarity will inform the performance she or he gives in any particular film. The specific repertoire of gestures, intonations, etc. that a star establishes over a number of films carries the meaning of her, his image just as much as the inert element of appearance, the particular sound of her, his voice, or dress style. So not only do stars all look unique, they all look different, they have defining features that separates them out, but they use their bodies and their voices in distinctive ways. And this carries through their films despite playing different types of character. So John Wayne might perform very different characters during his throughout his career, sometimes playing Irish characters, sometimes playing American cowboys, but ultimately he's always John Wayne. He always moves in a particular way, talks in a particular way. He has a signature style. Okay. So all of this, everything I've talked about so far, puts much greater weight on the star actor than other members of the production team, most notably the director. This is about dethroning the director as the ultimate author of all meaning and style in a movie. An important tradition in film history, Richard Dyer points out towards the end of his book, has tended to deny that performance has any expressive value. What you read into the performer, you read in by virtue of signs other than performance signs. So again, in the 1960s, it became very popular in film theory to assert that actors don't really do anything in film. They don't need to. A director tells them to look over there, and he selects a close-up of them looking over there, and then he cuts to an object, and that conveys the meaning. Character, actor looks, that's what they're looking at. Meaning. Okay. There isn't much scope for the actor to really do anything. The actor on the stage, though, would, when they look at something to make sure we're looking at the right thing, they would have to do more so that we behold what it is they're looking at. So there's a greater role for actors in theatre than in film. So somehow, once you're working with actors in film, you're robbing them of some agency. Dyer's beginning to contribute to a debate that starts to break this down and starts to make us look at acting much more closely again and think very carefully about the minute things that film actors are required to do, the tiny movements of their eyes that signify meaning, character. Okay, now there are four main concluding remarks at the end of Dyer's book that are just worth reviewing here, which point towards where more research needed to be done back in the late 1970s. And these are the areas that other scholars have gone on to develop in more detail. The first and most important is around the notion of the audience. What do audiences actually do with film? What do they do with stars? What do they do with film in terms of making meaning? So, he writes in his conclusion, the audience is fundamental to every assumption one can make about how stars and films work. Two, stars can provide insight into ideological crises. And this is where he introduces another one of his particularly important and influential concepts, the notion of charisma. And this becomes really important in scholarship from the 1980s on. Charisma. What does he mean by charisma? This sense of crisis as to what a person is seems to me to be central also to the star phenomenon. It can be seen to lie behind star charisma as a generalized phenomenon, in that stars speak centrally to this crisis and seem to embody it, or to condense it within themselves. So stars are a way for ideological crises, ideas out there in society that are challenging each other and are kind of being fought out culturally, are often articulated through stars and those stars who become popular at those particular moments. They represent these moments of cultural, social, ideological crisis. How they speak to, embody, or condense it may be predominantly in terms of reaffirming the reality of people as individuals or subjects over against ideology and history, or else in terms of exposing precisely the uncertainty and anxiety concerning the definition of what a person is. Whether affirming or exposing or moving beyond the two, stars articulate this crisis always through the cultural and historical specificities of class, gender, race, sexuality, religion, subcultural formations, etc. Yet all stars seem to me to work at more general levels, itself culturally and historically specific, of defining what a person is. So ultimately, the contradictions of a star comes about from defining who they are. Are they a type? Are they individual? Do they represent a particular gender, a particular sexuality at that moment in time? Do they represent a particular racial identity or a particular class identity? What is it that they represent at that time? And part of their magic, their charisma, their charm that makes them so appealing and so unique is their ability maybe to collapse a series of contradictions that are relevant to that society at that cultural moment. Okay, and I'll give you an example of that in a lecture tomorrow, I think, around Brigitte Bardot and how Brigitte Bardot signifies a certain kind of female sexuality in 1950s France and how she collapses a whole set of contradictions that make her at the same time modern and traditional. And then later on, towards the end of, I think on Wednesday, I'll be talking about the Bollywood star Aishwarya Rai, and again the way in which her charisma, her magic, comes from this contradiction between seeming modern, global and cosmopolitan on the one hand, and Indian and traditionally feminine on the other hand. And it's the fact that those two aspects of her character seem to be irreconcilable, and yet she functions in both those ways, that make her kind of magical, special, charming, and appealing. So this is often the function of a star, is that they take a set of contradictions and they mould them together as part of their identity. And that's what makes them fascinating, intriguing. That's why we want to go and see them in film after film, to try and work out these contradictions, this puzzle that they're proposing to us, and why we want to consume aspects of their publicity and promotional material to try and get closer to what it is they're struggling to articulate. Ultimately, what they're struggling to articulate is humanness, is what it is to be themselves, their own particular person in society at that moment. And that's part of the social function of stars, to articulate for us all those contradictions and what it is to be human at any one time, in any one place. Okay, those are two of his conclusions. There are still two more conclusions remaining for where more work needed to be done. His third conclusion was that we need to grasp the radical potential of stars for marginal audiences. So mass, mainstream stars, the reason they're stars is because they speak to everyone or nearly everyone, or at least big audiences. Millions of people from around the world will go and see them in their films, will purchase their DVDs, will buy their merchandising. That's what makes them stars. Okay, But also, some of those really big global stars work particularly for marginal audiences who feel much more disenfranchised, who don't feel part of the big society, the big global society. And yet they still see something in those stars that they can attach to. We need to understand how mainstream and marginal audiences can all find meaning in that one star who can speak to everyone. Okay, and then finally he says we need to retain a place for beauty, pleasure and delight when conducting film analysis and interpretation. I think right at the end of his book, I think he was aware that he was making star studies very scientific, very systematic. And what he didn't want to do was in kind of giving people a sense of how they could decode stars and think about the social meanings of stars in a wider context, that he didn't destroy the magic of stars either. Because ultimately, stars are magical to us, charismatic to us, because they represent pure beauty, pleasure, delight, and maybe truth, some kind of truth, whatever we understand that to mean. Okay. So this is now my conclusion. Stars, the book Stars, was not the first sustained academic book-length study of film stars and stardom. Edgar Morin had produced that back in France in 1957. Nevertheless, it was the most important for film studies, and it's the one that created the seismic shift and redefined star studies, gave it a name. It drew on and it synthesized a large body of existing literature on stars that already existed but needed to be kind of gathered together, collated and synthesized. But what it did, and this is the really important thing, is that it laid the foundations of what would become, certainly by the 1990s, a recognized subdisciplinary field within film studies, a branch of film studies in which quite a number of people have been working. It gave this branch of film studies its own particular concepts, particular areas of investigation, particular methodologies for analysing stars, thinking about stars, and for also promoting analysis of stars as texts that weren't just films, but were also publicity, TV appearances, adverts, endorsements, magazine articles, interviews, critical reviews, etc. And it was also important for getting us to look again at what stars do as performers, as actors, the nuances of what they're doing. That doesn't just rest with the director or the cinematographer, but gives themselves some kind of agency, some control over their work. Okay. That's as far as I'm going to get today. So that introduces you to really the starting point of this theory back in 1979. In the next lecture, I'll be talking to you about what happened after this period in the 90s and how these theories became elaborated. And then I'll start to take us down a more historical route where we look at how stars functioned within the cinema, as kind of within the economic system of cinema, how the funding for films and the distribution of films relied on stars, but also the employment conditions under which stars have been employed, particularly within Hollywood. Are there any questions? Is there anything I've said that you don't understand or you would like more information about? Okay, well, it's